Full Story is supported by AMP Super. There are moments in life where everything shifts. A new job, a new home, a new direction. But those same moments can also shape your future. AMP calls these super moments. Times to check in on your super. And with 24/7 digital financial advice, AMP Super helps you make more confident decisions as your situation changes. Search AMP Super Moments to find out more. AMP Super. Built for life's super moments. AMP Super, issued by NM Superannuation Proprietary Limited. See PDS and TMD on amp.com.au and consider what's right for you.
This is The Guardian.
He's been a friend of mine. He's been somebody that we get along with. And I think you're going to see that good things are going to happen. This is going to be a very exciting trip. A lot of good things are going to happen.
I'm Regid Ahmed.
And I'm Jonathan Yeroshelmi.
And this is Decoding America, a podcast from Guardian Australia. Well, Jonathan, for a long time, Donald Trump has had China in his sights as the enemy. But as we just heard there, he's departing for Beijing, maybe off to make some friends.
Yeah, Donald Trump is heading into this meeting with a lot on his plate. A stalemate in the Iran war, rising inflation, fast approaching midterm elections. But he is, of course, leaving time for his own passion projects.
I'm good at ballrooms, and we're giving you the... I believe it's the best... It will be the best ever built. And it will have windows that are thicker than any ballroom I've ever built.
Donald Trump's beloved ballroom. We're going to talk about the price tag a bit later on. But first, we'll focus on China because that's a big trip happening. It's the first trip by a US president in nearly 10 years to China, postponed because of the Iran war. Why is he going now?
I think we need to think a little bit about the past year to get to that. So the US and China have just been through this bruising trade war. We're in a kind of truce now, but at one point, tariffs on Chinese goods coming into the US were about 145%. Yeah. They're still really, really high historically. And Trump, going into this meeting, has been enforcing strict discipline on China for several months. He does not want to rock the boat. He wants a win. So he's been telling his cabinet members, his officials, let's not go too hard on China because I want to go into this meeting and secure some wins.
Yeah, he wants to get something out of it.
Exactly. It's whether it's economic things, trade things, he wants to settle that relationship and get over that because, as we heard, he has a lot on his plate at the moment.
Donald Trump has really changed his tune on China over the last decade. The difference a decade makes is astonishing because this is something he said back in 2016.
We can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing. It's the greatest theft in the history of the world.
You probably remember him saying things like that as he ran for president the first time around. Now they're best friends. I mean, what's changed?
You know, I think when Donald Trump came to power, his political ascendancy relied so much on China, didn't it? His whole message was that we as a country, America, have been ruined by China through trade deals, between lowering of trade tariffs, you know, China becoming the world's manufacturing workshop, and that hollowing out the base in the Rust Belt and places like that. So much of what he was running on in 2016 was the fact that places like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania had had their economies and their livelihoods hollowed out because manufacturing had moved from the US to China. And this was something new in American politics, wasn't it? Like before that, there was a kind of bipartisan consensus between the Democrats and the Republicans that this trading relationship with China served America, that it was fine that they were importing so much, that it was fine that there was this huge trade imbalance. And Donald Trump really came in and changed that. And I would say, to Donald Trump's credit, that is the new consensus in Washington. A lot of what he did in terms of tariffs in his first time, you know, Joe Biden continued those things. And I think whether it's the view of China as a kind of economic competitor or whether it's the more serious view that a lot of people take that they are a national security threat, that war with China is somehow imminent or likely to happen, that is the consensus in Washington now, broadly speaking.
the consensus being that China is a problem?
Yeah, that China's a threat. And, you know, Donald Trump's cabinet is stacked with China hawks. Marco Rubio is someone who's been very critical of China. He's actually under sanctions from China, so it's interesting that he's going on this trip. You've got other people like J.D. Vance. You've got trade advisors. And I think the view was that going into this second term, Trump would be even harder on China, that perhaps we'd be looking at severing of ties to an even greater extent. But I think if you speak to a lot of experts, they think that the hawks in his administration have been kind of brushed aside somewhat. Donald Trump has obviously been focused on a lot of different things during this administration, this second term, whether it be immigration, the war in Iran, Venezuela. And I think that there was this idea that, you know, he would be tough on China, but you know, there were tariff wars on China, but there were tariff wars on Europe. There are tariff wars on the UK. There are tariff wars on Australia. I think that some people have been disappointed that he hasn't gone hard enough.
So some of the heat has maybe come out of that relationship. I do remember in 2016, I felt like that attack on China was tapping into the frustration that Americans felt that jobs, manufacturing had left the country. So it politically worked for him.
Not just that, though. It was also this tapping into something that I think we in Australia see as completely normal now, which is that China is a national security threat, whether that be espionage, whether that be kind of real violence happening in the South China Sea and things like that. Donald Trump didn't invent that idea, but he certainly brought it to the fore through his administration. I don't know if you remember covering the early days of the first administration in 2017, this thing, this Thucydides trap. Do you remember this?
I don't, no.
You have a much more active social life than I do. This was this idea that it's, you know, Thucydides was an ancient Greek historian, and he had this idea that this trap, that if there is a rising power and a kind of sustained superpower, at some point, they will go to war. And this was something Steve Bannon, Trump's advisor, was obsessed with. And in 2017, there was op-eds in the New York Times, The Atlantic, people obsessed with this idea that eventually this relationship would end in war. And that became almost an accepted idea. And I think that what we're seeing now is that Donald Trump is perhaps not the hawk we thought he was, that he is more keen on a kind of pragmatic economic relationship.
Can I venture a reason for that? How much does it come down to the relationship between Trump and Xi and the fact that Donald Trump likes Xi Jinping?
Yeah, I think it's clear that he does quite like him before he came.
It's all personal relationships for Donald Trump.
Yeah, and look, it's no secret. He admires kind of strongmen, authoritarians. You know, he does seem to admire Vladimir Putin. I think before he left on this meeting, he said he expected Xi Jinping to give him a big hug when he got there. Last year, Donald Trump was musing on a meeting he'd had with Xi in his first term, saying that he remembered sitting there and all of Xi's advisors being completely silent. They were terrified of him. And he asked, why are my advisors terrified of me? So he clearly does seem to like that. He was obviously joking. But yeah, the relationship there is clearly important. And Donald Trump respects him. And I think he hopes that Xi Jinping respects him too.
And it's perhaps helped sort of smooth out some of the earlier, you know, hardline approach to China. What does China want to get out of this before we move on? Because we got to talk about the tech bros that are going along as well. But what is China hoping to get?
Look, China wants to kind of recalibrate that economic relationship. I think it's really telling that the person leading in the White House on the China relationship now is Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary. It's not Marco Rubio. It's not a national security advisor person. That shows us that Trump sees this primarily as an economic relationship. And China wants to see some of those tariffs that are still really high brought down, not just the tariffs as well. The Strait of Hormuz, that remains closed. We've talked about it almost every week we've been doing this podcast. And I think that a huge amount of China's energy comes through the Strait. So they want to see that sorted out. Whether or not they're willing to kind of really get involved there diplomatically, that remains to be seen. I think it's likely that Donald Trump will ask them. That's an awkward position for Donald Trump. He doesn't want to be going to...
He doesn't want to bend the knee.
Exactly. Mm. And, you know, I don't even know if we'd characterize it like that. He just doesn't want to be going with requests. But certainly that's something they want. You know, Xi also wants Taiwan. This is a hugely important part of China. They see Taiwan, which is a self-governing island with its own government, as part of China. Xi Jinping has been very clear that within the next few years, he wants to see Taiwan brought under China's umbrella, that whether that be militarily or other ways, he said that. Donald Trump, you know, to his credit, has always been clear that that is not on the cards. The US, along with many other countries, have remained this strategic ambiguity when it comes to Taiwan. They don't say they would get involved in a war, but they don't say they wouldn't. And I think even a subtle change in language in the approach that the US takes to Taiwan is something that Xi Jinping would see as a win.
That's a really important point, especially for Australians, because there's always a conversation here about whether we would join any effort against China if China moved against Taiwan. Do you think it's possible that Xi Jinping could extract any concessions out of Donald Trump?
Well, look, there's clearly things that Donald Trump wants. He wants help with the strait. He wants changes in the economic relationship. We know that he wants China to be buying more soybeans. We know he wants them to buy Boeing planes and things like that. Whether that's enough for him to change decades of US foreign policy, I feel like that's unlikely. But yeah, there are very narrow things he could do that China at least would see as a win.
I mean, we've talked about how there's this history of real anger with China coming from Donald Trump, but has he necessarily changed anything about the relationship between China and the US in his 10 years of being on the world stage?
He definitely has. One of the big things animating Donald Trump was this trade deficit. This is the difference between how much America buys from China and how much China buys from America. So the US is importing so much more from China than it's sending to China. And that's the same for most countries. China is the manufacturing hub of the world. That's not surprising. They have lower costs. That's why companies like Apple make their products in China. But Donald Trump wants to see manufacturing return to America. And one of the ways he's doing that is tariffs. And so if you look at that trade deficit, in 2017, when Donald Trump became president, it was $375 billion. Last year, $202 billion, expected this year to be $134 billion. That's the lowest it's been in 20 years. You know, Chinese goods were almost a quarter of all U.S. imports before Trump came to power. It's likely to be just over 7% this year. So that is a massive win for Donald Trump. However, if we're looking at whether this is bringing back manufacturing to the U.S., the U.S.'s overall trade deficit with the rest of the world has actually gotten bigger. It's almost doubled since Trump became president. So even though he's managed to fix that with China, it just means that companies like Apple are moving their manufacturing to other countries, Vietnam being one of them. And that's not a sign that this manufacturing base is being revived in America.
No, and that's what the American public wanted.
Well, it's certainly what Donald Trump wants. So I think it shows maybe the limits to what tariffs on their own can do.
Before we move on to the tech bros, can we play Who Said It and What Were They Talking About very briefly? This is going to give us a sense of what Donald Trump might want out of China on the Strait of Hormuz. I hope the Chinese tell him what he needs to be told, and that is that what you are doing in the Strait is causing you to be globally isolated. You're the bad guy in this.
Oh, I don't know. Who said that?
Marco Rubio to China about when the Iranian foreign minister went to visit Beijing.
Right.
Pot kettle black.
Yes. Look, it's a strange situation they found themselves in. I don't think they quite know how to solve this one, and any help that China could give them, you know, would be greatly received.
I want to talk to you about who is going along on this trip, because I saw the headlines that Elon Musk, outgoing Apple CEO Tim Cook, is going along as well. And I was kind of stunned. I almost thought, is this a bit of a joke? How unusual is that to be having these very high-profile billionaires go along with him?
It's not unusual at all. I think that when leaders go on these visits overseas, they bring business leaders with them because they want to try and, you know, push trade in those countries. When Anthony Albanese traveled to China last year, he brought business leaders from, you know, Rio Tinto, from Fortescue with him. They want to try and cut deals when they're there. That's part of why they're doing
this. But is there something different here, especially with Elon Musk? Because it would be like Albanese taking Gina Reinhart with him. Elon Musk has been so involved in White House politics. There's a bit of an optics discomfort for me.
Yeah, look, and we don't know what the status of the relationship between Elon Musk and Donald Trump is. They obviously fell out in a very public way last year after being best buds for a while. But Tesla is a hugely important company to America. It, you know, manufactures a lot of its cars in China. You know, the same with Tim Cook and Apple. That is a really, really important relationship. And it kind of points to one of the other things they're going to be talking about, which is AI, that is such an important factor of these discussions.
Right. It's the AI wars. Okay. So it's not, it doesn't, maybe it just looks unusual because we are hyper-focused whenever Donald Trump interacts with these big tech billionaires.
Yeah, look, I think there's no hiding the fact that these tech leaders are close to Donald Trump, that they've helped him. You know, they were in prime position at his inauguration last year. But, you know, they're really important to the U.S. economy. The AI boom is so important to the U.S. economy. NVIDIA, this chip company, this U.S. chip company, their market cap is larger than Australia's GDP. These companies are huge. And he needs to make sure. I know it's strange, isn't it? But he needs to make sure that they are, you know, that they're making as much money as they can be.
I did find a list reported of who Donald Trump took along in 2017, and it was described as the old economy. And it does go to your point: Boeing, General Electric, Goldman Sachs. Those are the people who went along just under 10 years ago.
Well, I think the Boeing CEO is on this trip as well. I need to check that, but I think that's one of the big deals they're looking at. But you're right.
Not changed as much.
I think the AI thing is such a huge thing. Joe Biden, when he was president, put in this huge measure to try and restrict sales of semiconductors, chips, to China. That was a huge part of his policy and, you know, a continuation of this idea from Donald Trump that China is a national security threat. We need to be protecting our own technology, our technology prowess, and that we cannot be allowing China to steal, you know, what we have. That didn't go down that well with a lot of the tech companies who want to be selling these semiconductors to China. China is a huge player in the AI industry. Donald Trump has kind of softened that a bit. He's allowed companies like NVIDIA to sell some of their higher capacity chips to China. That has been seen, you know, in a number of different ways. I think a lot of people see that as just pragmatism. China's going to get there anyway. We may as well make some money out of it. I'd note as well that the White House is taking a cut of those sales, 25% of those sales. That's, you know, Donald Trump is a deal maker. Others see it as, you know, a threat to the US's national security. But any way you look at it, this AI stuff, the tech stuff, the chip stuff is a vital part of this meeting.
It's kind of the future. Can we characterize it as AI wars, or is it more AI talks?
It's an AI arms race. I think the US wants to make sure that it's keeping its position as the AI leader. People estimate that the US is about 8 months ahead of China when it comes to AI development, but they're also using AI in very different ways.
I've heard, because I'm sure everyone saw the Kung Fu Robot videos on Instagram, they're quite astonishing to watch, and a lot of it's being described as China's kind of ahead on the robotics, but America is ahead on the chips, and they sort of potentially need to meet in the middle somehow.
Yeah, I think the view is that China has been much better at implementing AI in everyday life, mechanization, automation, all of those things. You know, I was speaking to Amy Hawkins, our Beijing correspondent, yesterday about all of this stuff. She says that in China, it's just such a part of your daily life, and people don't have that fear that we have in Australia or in America that AI is going to take our jobs, that it's going to destroy the world. It's just, you know, there's a bit of that, but it's just not part of the conversation in the same way. In the US, they're more focused on this super intelligence, creating these AIs that will be able to do everything. And that's probably a bit where that fear comes from.
On that, I found it fascinating. China's courts recently made it illegal to fire people if a company just wants to replace them with AI. And that suggests to me that China's a bit worried, but also maybe thinking about it more than we are.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the benefit of living in an authoritarian state when the government can just step in and do these things. But it's also perhaps why they're a bit behind, because, you know, in America, the free market is allowed to go and do their things fairly unhassled by the government.
Wait, what is the saying? Was it the Google saying, go fast and break things and presumably ask questions later?
I think that is the view of a lot of those tech companies.
Very briefly before we move on to the ballroom, what isn't on the agenda? What's missing?
Look, I think a lot of people in Europe would have liked to see Ukraine on the agenda. China is, you know, Russia's biggest backer. They're buying so much of their commodities, so much of their energy. I think it's difficult to see how Russia could continue this war if China stepped in and started putting their foot down. It doesn't appear Xi Jinping is going to do that. He has this no-limits friendship with Vladimir Putin. I don't think there's any indication that this is a matter up for discussion during these talks.
I heard Malcolm Turnbull give an interview, the former Australian Prime Minister, with the BBC, and it left an impression on me because he said, even though the US is walking away from our traditional international order, China is still seeing value in it and trying to preserve some of it.
Well, I think it's just a different dynamic, isn't it? China sees these as business relationships. I think the fear for a lot of people in our region, in Southeast Asia, in Australia, is that there is war between these two, yes, but also that they just go up and blindly, you know, carve up the world between them and have these binary relationships. I think either way, there's a lot of fear looking at the way that China and the US interact.
All right. Well, there's one thing that Donald Trump definitely can't stop talking about, and it's that ballroom, now no longer at a low, low discount price of just $400 million. Donald Trump is now having to explain why taxpayers could be on the hook for $1 billion for this ballroom.
They're not, because that's for many other projects. That's for projects having to do with safety in a certain section of the White House grounds. That's not all for the ballroom.
I don't think that's a great explanation for why the costs have ballooned.
Yeah, so let's just explain quickly what this ballroom is. So last year, Donald Trump started demolishing the east wing of the White House. This is a historic part of the White House. And he said he was doing it because he wanted to build this huge new ballroom there. It was going to be beautiful columns. He talks about the windows a lot. He talks about the finishes. He's really into this ballroom. I cannot stress that enough. And
had a real estate man at heart.
I mean, he just is, isn't he? But I think recently it was halted by a preservation society, which challenged it in court. And he was told he wasn't allowed to do it. He didn't seek permission to do it. You know, he says he didn't need to. It's all wrapped up in the courts at the moment. And at the moment, we're in a situation where some construction is allowed to continue, but the broader kind of bigger picture of the ballroom, that is not allowed to go ahead, because a lot of people are concerned about the designs of this ballroom because it frankly is huge. It is almost bigger than the entire White House. It's going to be this annex that is, you know, so overblown.
No wonder it's costing so much. As soon as the White House Correspondents' Dinner shooting happened, the White House and the Department of Justice really capitalized on that, didn't they? And they said, we need this for security.
Yeah, it was so interesting when that happened, because I was covering the news that day and I saw that there almost seemed to be this coordinated campaign amongst Trump acolytes, influencers, government officials, Republicans, who all at once in tandem were tweeting about why this is why we need a ballroom, an attack on a hotel in Washington, D.C., hosting the president and his advisors and his wife. You know, this wouldn't have happened if they were in the security of a White House ballroom. And I think that's given it, you know, impetus to go ahead and for Republicans to now make this a kind of budgetary issue. Lindsey Graham, the senator, very close Trump ally, he's come out with a bill saying that, you know, we need to use taxpayer money to pay for this ballroom. It started at $200 million, then it was $400 million. This bill is putting aside about $1 billion for it. And when questioned on what the private donations were going to go towards, because remember, Donald Trump said, don't worry, the taxpayer's not picking up
the tab on this.
It's going to be private donations. I'm paying for it. Well, Lindsey Graham said, well, you know, that money could be used for buying China and stuff like that.
The Democrats are pushing back, but I do kind of wonder what happens if the Democrats win the midterms and this thing hasn't been built.
Well, look, I think it's currently wrapped up in a funding bill to do with ICE and immigration. Who knows where it's going to end up? But there's no doubt that Donald Trump is obsessed with this. He keeps bringing up the ballroom. So he was recently on Air Force One. He went back a few seats to talk to journalists. They expected him to be talking about the Iran war. He appeared with these huge renderings of the ballroom and just started talking them through it, how it was going to look. Washington Post has done some analysis on this, and they found that he's talking about the ballroom once every 3 days publicly. That's about as much as he's talking about health insurance or affordability.
But the thing is, Donald Trump is a headlines man as well, and billion-dollar ballroom, I just see that across all of the papers. The optics are not good, especially with new inflation figures out showing that the cost of living squeeze is really increasing.
Yeah, and the polls bear that out. 58% of Americans are against this ballroom. They're sick of him talking about it, but he cannot stop talking about it.
All right, well, Donald Trump can't stop talking about it, but we will. We're going to go to a break. And when we come back, it's maps and the midterms. Some states are going hell for leather, capitalizing on those changes to the Voting Rights Act. Well, welcome back. Jonathan, last week we talked about these key changes that the US Supreme Court made to the Voting Rights Act. They're monumental. They're complicated, but they essentially allow different states to redraw their electoral maps without having to consider race in the way that they used to. And we are seeing states rapidly move to take advantage of that.
Yeah. So just in the last week, we've had Alabama. That's a southern state. They are going to redraw their map. They're going to get rid of one of their Democratic seats probably through doing that. Tennessee, I mentioned it last week. You've got this one district dominated by Memphis, a black majority city, a hugely important city in the U.S. South. They're going to draw lines all through that city to cut it up so that the black majority there are now a minority. That's probably going to get rid of that seat as well. And there's not much good news for Democrats either, because there was this referendum in Virginia where people voted to allow to change the makeup of their seats as well to make it more Democrat. That referendum was won. That was going to hand them, I think, five or six more seats to the Democrats. But the state Supreme Court, the Virginia Supreme Court, has overturned that on a basic technicality. But it means it won't be in time for the midterms in November.
So we're basically seeing red states especially just move really rapidly to take advantage and sort of that electoral district landscape change. What does it mean for the midterms now? Can the Democrats even win?
It's a really difficult question to answer. I think analysts have been looking at what's happened. They're looking at some of the changes over the last week. And what they've found is that these redistricting efforts, these new maps, have probably handed Republicans 14 more seats that they can probably win. And what the Democrats have done in California have probably handed them about six more seats. Now, the House of Representatives at the moment has a very narrow Republican majority. So, you know, looking at the changes that they made, that could hand Republicans a massive win. But we need to think about Trump's approval. Trump's approval,
right,
according to new polls, has reached an all-time low for his presidency. There was a poll by ABC News America last week showing it at about 37%. With approval like that, it seems very difficult to see that the Republicans could win this election, because Americans are voting on his presidency. You know, as much as a lot of Congress people say that it's not about that, it is about that.
You can gerrymander as much as you want, but people will still vote.
Yes, so we'll likely be seeing places that are normally really reliable Republican seats, whether they're House or Senate seats, turning blue, going Democrat, just because of how unpopular the president is. However, the long-term picture for Democrats, so beyond this midterm, if we look towards the 2028 elections, the midterms after that, all of this redistricting means that in a normal year, the House is stacked in Republicans' favor.
It's the long game.
Exactly. It's the long game, and it's going to be really difficult in years where maybe the Democrats are holding the White House and the public hate them. It's going to be really difficult for them to hang on to the House.
It's what a way to run a democracy. I just marvel. Look, Jonathan, I'm sure we'll have so much more to talk about. We'll chat next week.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Decoding America is a podcast by Guardian Australia and was recorded on Gadigal land. This episode was produced by Daniel Simo, who also did the sound design and mixing. Theme composed by Joe Koning. And the executive producer is Hannah Parks. I'm Regid Ahmed. Jonathan and I will be back next week in your full story feed.